learning all about the global warming hoax. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, my Vice Chairman, fellow analyst, and my good friend, Chuck Michaels.
And it's good to be with you again today, Barry. And this is a very interesting topic for me. I've paid attention to this actually for a number of years.
Yes, and those who tuned in yesterday know that we're talking about a fact that a new set of temperature data that has been released by the East Anglian Climatic Measurement Unit, and I got that name wrong, the East Anglian Climatic Research Unit, the epicenter for the global warming crowd. This is one of the key institutions that they've been pulling models from and data from to say, look, the Earth is getting warmer and warmer, and pretty soon people are going to die, and the coastlines, the water levels are going to rise, all the icebergs are going to melt, all the poor polar bears are going to drown, and then a lot of people are going to die who live on the coast. Well, that's at least what Al Gore said in his movie An Inconvenient Truth and the book that went with it. But come to find out, lo and behold, with this release of new temperature data, there's a lot of scientists that are now saying, well, wait a minute, this data proves that there hasn't been any warming for the last 15 years, since 1997 was the last time that there was any noticeable warming of the overall temperature of the Earth. But for the last 15 years, instead of, as the models predicted, it getting warmer and warmer and warmer from about 2000 forward, it's actually stabilized and actually started getting colder. They say that now the Earth is actually about up to a half degree cooler than it was in 2000. So, Chuck, you know, we've got to talk about this whole ideology behind global warming. And I know that with you with a science background, and you've studied this quite a bit, kind of walk us through some of these things.
Well, I'm going to be quite honest. My interest has to do with the sunspot activity. And I noticed years ago, just a mere observation, because I watched the sunspot cycle because, now this may sound strange, because I'm a shortwave radio fan. And I was at one time an aspiring ham radio operator. I've never gotten my license, and it's mostly out of laziness because I didn't want to learn the Morse code. But I would watch sunspot activity to find out how good the shortwave radio reception was going to be. And that's a well-known phenomena, and you can look up the ARRL, American Radio Relay League's website, you can look up QST Magazine, you can look up CQ Magazine, and they actually every month publish the sunspot numbers and the prediction for the next month. And the reason for that is propagation. So you can tell if when the sun, and let's put it this way, when the sunspot numbers are high, the atmosphere, the parts of the atmosphere that skip radio signals are very active. And the more active the sun, the higher the frequency that will skip back to Earth. And the better, the lower frequencies are at bouncing around the world. And when the sunspot is at a minimum, radio communication in some cases just goes really bad, except on the much lower frequencies. So I used to watch this, and I did notice that there seemed to be a correlation between sunspot activity and the way our summers and our winters were and those kinds of things. And the fact is that during the 80s, when it was so very warm, and parts of the 90s when it was so very warm, the sunspot activity was extremely high. In fact, the cycle that ended, oh gosh, around 2000 or so, had a double peak, what they call a double peak. In other words, the sunspot numbers peaked out and then dropped off and then peaked out again. Well, that's not unheard of, but it's kind of rare. And that was at the end of the last glow. Now, if you go out and look at the warmest part of the 80s and 90s, you will find that both those peaks are right around the peak of sunspot activity. And you will also find that the sun was extremely active in sunspots during that part. Now, as the 2000s have come along, we've seen a deep slowdown. The last peak was pretty low. Peak 24 was probably Oh, gosh. The highest peak was in around in the 50s on record, and it was over 200 sunspots. The sunspot index was 200. I think the last one that was ended about 2006 or 7, somewhere in there, was
it was
under 100. The index was under 100. So it was less than half of the highest one. Okay. Peak 25 is, they're predicting it's going to be, the sunspot index is going to be, oh gosh, probably about 10 or under. Well, that's way low. And when you start getting into those numbers, you're looking at some of the minimum, what they called the minimums. There are a couple of important sunspot minimums. One of them called the Maunder minimum that came just after what is known as the medieval climate optimum. And that was the extremely warm period from about 1,000 to about, 1,300 or so. Uh-huh. And the temperature in Europe was much warmer. And the fact is that if you'll note, that Greenland, the island of Greenland, got its name from the Vikings because they landed there, and it was extremely green there, and they colonized Greenland. The sunspots came, and it got much warmer, and that was fine. And then all of a sudden, this minimum came, and boy, the ice age hit, and all those villages that the Vikings built suddenly found themselves under 100 feet of glacial ice.
Right, and that minimum was about from about 1660 or so through about the early 1700s, 1730, I believe.
Right, and then there was another minimum, the Dalton minimum.
Right, which was about 1770 to 1830.
Right, and that was another extremely cold period. In fact, a lot of these paintings you'll see of ice skating on the River Thames in London were painted during that period because there was such a thing. You go to London, there hasn't been ice over the Thames in, oh gosh, over 100 years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so we have these periods, these cyclic periods of extreme warm, extreme cold, and that's because our sun is a variable star.
That's true.
Well, so we have to understand that what is happening is the climate alarmists are famous for saying, well, you guys have to remember that weather isn't climate. Well, that's true, because what's happening here in Ohio may have nothing to do with what's going on worldwide. We may just have a little dip in temperature here due to, you know, the jet stream or whatever, and everywhere else it's balmy, you know, everywhere to the south of us, and the average mm-hmm. global temperature may be up. But the fact is that these guys have forgotten their own adage, and that is that weather isn't climate. Climate is the overall picture, and they haven't been looking very hard, because I've known there wasn't any warming since at least 2000 for years, because I've paid attention to guys like Dr. Michael Kaufman of Environmental Perspectives Incorporated, who I've had into Camp American to talk about these things.
Yes. This is where I learned a lot about this myself, was listening to you two discuss this with Michael and giving presentations to the students, and then the conversations that we have in between classes discussing these type of things. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is a great time for your children or your grandchildren to come this summer to camp. I think the dates are, what, June 24th through the 30th this year, Charles?
That's right, June 24th through 30th.
For ages 12 and up.
www.campamerican.com.
Camp American, to send your kids, and maybe even to come yourself, because you can hear the discussions with experts such as Dr. Michael Kaufman of Environmental Perspectives, with Chuck, who heads up Camp American, with others. I mean, we talk about so many different issues. We bring in top-notch people. Professor Charles Rice from Notre Dame University comes in to discuss. Chuck, I mean, it's just, the list goes on. I could go back to the history of all the folks that you've had in who are experts in their fields that we bring in to teach these students about the biblical frameworks and how policies are made with specific worldview. And that's what we're talking about here, because, you know, obviously our government has been making quite a few policies based upon these predictive models that Al Gore has been going around the planet touting for the last, 8 or 10 years since he lost his run for office.
Well, and let's make ourselves pretty clear. Al Gore has made a fortune touting a false picture of global catastrophe. And the fact is, while this green economy was being cooked up by liberals, Al Gore at one point, had we signed the Kyoto Treaty, stood to make billions of dollars.
Yes.
On his quote-unquote green investments. And the fact is that a lot of that is beginning to crumble because, first of all, nobody wants $55,000 cars that'll go 40 miles an hour for 40 miles before you need to stop and plug them in. Nobody wants $50,000 5-kilowatt solar generators on their roof that basically never pay for themselves. The maintenance and the original costs never make up in the amount that you feed back to the grid because the amount of electricity that it created is it won't even run a refrigerator and a furnace at the same time. So the fact is that, yeah, can we improve these things? Yes. And should they be improved? Yes, they should be improved by private investment, not by pumping taxpayer money into them in the most corrupt manner possible.
Well, absolutely. Well, and the other thing is, Chuck, I mean, we've been talking about this, but that's not the only big thing that's been in the news. Just last week, three different companies, green companies, who received tens of millions of taxpayer dollars in stimulus grants for green energy projects, either went out of business or laid off the vast majority of their workforce, and thus likely reneging on their promises for jobs and production. But our tax dollars are already spent. That's the problem with creating policies around theories and not around data.
Well, that's right. And Barry, this is not the first time this has happened. I mean, for instance, one of the worst players in this, in that exploiting science for profit, believe it or not, is NASA. One of the most amazing things I've seen is this idea. Every time interest wanes in a trip to Mars, NASA comes up with something where they're going to send a satellite. They're going to look for signs of life on Mars. Well, the latest thing is about how they've found so many Earth-like, quote-unquote Earth-like planets that may or may not contain life. Well, some of these planets are circling stars that can't possibly support life because they're, for instance, their radiation patterns are such that nothing like life that we know here could exist there. And the fact is these, quote-unquote Earth-like planets are really gas giants. They're more like Saturn than they are like the Earth. Now, lately, they supposedly have discovered some planets that are supposedly a lot like Earth, but you read the descriptions, they're not really like Earth at all. And the fact is that most of them aren't directly observed. It's all indirect observation, which means that the numbers are all whopper-jawed. Don't know for sure if the numbers are correct or not. So NASA is working desperately to try to get back to its 1960s funding levels. I don't see it happening, Barry, because there's just not enough payoff really in the long run from the space program.
No, not at all. But we still have to pay for those bad decisions, and pay, pay, and pay we must. A company by the name, Chuck, of InnerOne, E-N-E-R-1, or it, maybe it's InnerI, I don't know, it looks like a one, who received $118 million of our taxpayer dollars from the stimulus package to make renewable batteries for the country's power grids, declared bankruptcy less than a year after receiving $118 million of our tax money.
Not shocking.
Not shocking.
And the problem being that these companies don't have business models that make it possible for them to go out to private investors and get investment. They have to go and see if they can get free money from the government. In other words, pick our pockets.
Yes. So if we hear candidates out on the stump or the administration trying to tout the fact that we need to invest in green energy because we have to combat global warming, ladies and gentlemen, look past the sound bites, get down to the data. We're wasting a lot of money and energy, which could be focused in better directions based upon the boogeyman scenarios of people like Al Gore.
And with that, we're out of time.
So join us tomorrow, 5:30, for more Principles and Policies.